time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And Uncle Dennis suggests that you have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write down some information that might be something you want to act on, something you want to plug into, somewhere you want to check out. Let's start out with an announcement from the Earth First Journal. The digital release of the latest Earth First Journal is now available. The latest issue of the Earth First Journal, our winter edition, Brigid 2014, is now available online for your viewing pleasure. I might note it is the first day of spring, so couldn't be more timely. Happy equinox to everyone. We are very excited to share the printed editions of the Earth First Journal in a digital format. Now we can more easily keep latitudes and eco-techies across the globe informed and inspired to defend our Earth from corporate domination and industrial contamination. To keep folks plugged in, your support is needed. Whether you've been a supporter throughout the years or are considering donating for the first time, your donation will help to get the biocentric, no-compromise perspective of the Earth First Media into the hands and on the screens of readers worldwide, from prisoners of the struggle to folks just now gearing up to take a stand for the Earth. If you're not currently subscribed to the Earth First Journal, give a read to our latest issue. And if you like what I see, consider sending us some love. Your support will help print and mail the next issue, the spring edition, Beltane 2014, which will be available this May. $7,000 is needed to get that printed edition out, and we're already on our way to meeting this goal. So subscribe or donate today to receive the spring issue. And for the Wild, the Earth First Journal Collective says you can make a donation via PayPal by emailing it to us at collective@earthfirstjournal.org from your PayPal account. Donations can also be mailed to Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 964, Lake Worth, Florida, 33460. Once again, that's collective@earthfirstjournal.org for the PayPal donations, or Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 964, Lake Worth, Florida, 33460, and you can go online at www.earthfirstjournal.org to view the latest electronic edition of the journal. And once again, coming up in April is the No Pipelines Training Camp. That's going to be taking place up around Vancouver, British Columbia. And this story by Root Force of the Earth First Newswire. Rising Tide is organizing a convergence weekend on April 4th, 5th, and 6th called No Pipelines Action Training for Climate Justice. This weekend will be for mass movement trainings focused on building resistance across our different organizing spaces to fight extreme energy expansion and its numerous resulting oppressions across Turtle Island. We would like to invite you, your collective group organization, to this event so we can learn from one another and strengthen our resolve to stop the expansion of extreme energy development and the exploitation of human and natural resources, and offer our support to communities on the front lines of the ecological crises. This weekend is designed to share popular education on mass movement building and citizen action to prepare hundreds of folks for civil disobedience and community organizing through skill shares and relationship building. We are looking to use these skills and new connections to plan public protests throughout 2014 against numerous mega projects proliferating the landscape, from oil and gas pipelines to coal export terminals, from fracking and mining projects to incinerators. For our future and for the future of all our communities and children, we need to act now. Once again, the dates for the No Pipelines Action Training for Climate Justice are April 4th, 5th, and 6th, and these trainings will be held at various locations in Vancouver, including Russian Hall and the Dogwood Center. If you want more information, please email risingtide604@riseup.net. Once again, that email address is risingtide604@riseup.net. And this whole thing is presented by At Rising Tide Vancouver, Coast Salish Territories. And the California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter, will be having a habitat restoration this Saturday, March 22nd, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Linda writes, I will be traveling to the Southern California mountains and near desert areas over the next several days. We will continue our broom bash efforts at Quail Hollow. removing invasive non-native French broom in the oak woodland areas. We have accomplished a lot, but there is still so much more to do. Chuck Bauman and Lee Summers will be leading this work party, so come on out and show your support. How to get to Quail Hollow? Go up Graham Hill Road out of Santa Cruz, come down into Felton, turn right at the first light, head up a couple of miles to east, up East Ziandi Road to Quail Hollow. Take a left. The park entrance is up the road about a half a mile on the right. Meet in the gravel parking lot on the left-hand side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided, bring gloves and water. For more information, contact Linda, but she's out of town. I guess you could go to their webpage at www.cruzcnps.org. That's CRUZCNPS.org. And here is the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. As the spring equinox approaches, wild buffalo calving season is barely a month away. This is the most critical time for buffalo and other wildlife who have struggled to survive the harsh winter, living on the meager offerings of sleeping grasses and their own stores of body fat. With these stores nearly depleted, most of the buffalo we are seeing appear thin, with protruding ribs, backs, and hump bones. Being forbidden access to lower elevation winter ranges takes a huge toll on the bison. In the past few months, more than 630 wild buffalo have been killed by humans, and winter kill will also be significant. Though snows are quickly melting, green-up is still weeks away, and now is the time when only the strongest will survive. There is danger even in the new ultra-rich spring grasses that will come as the digestive systems of buffalo and elk, used to breaking down coarse, dry winter fare, are vulnerable to overindulgence in the green grasses they so desperately need. Meanwhile, treaty hunting has continued. 23 more wild buffalo, including pregnant cows, were harvested over the weekend. Thankfully, no wild buffalo have been killed since Monday. We anticipate that treaty hunts will finally be over soon, though it is difficult to predict. Yellowstone National Park issued a press release on Tuesday announcing that three buffalo were poached in the Blacktail region of the park, shot and killed. While this news is very disturbing, we find great hypocrisy in the fact that the Park Service can capture and send hundreds of buffalo to slaughter while condemning others for committing similar crimes against the buffalo. Closure signs are still in place all around Yellowstone's Stevens Creek Bison Trap, and we have noticed a few more horses arriving to their corrals. While capture and slaughter operations may have ceased for the time being, we are ever vigilant for hazing or harassment operations to take place. Livestock interests are attempting to turn year-round habitat for buffalo into a slaughter agreement. Montana's Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and Montana's Department of Livestock met this week to discuss a draft proposal that would exchange wild buffalo lives for access to year-round habitat in the Hebgen Basin west of Yellowstone National Park. Essentially, if there are 4,000 buffalo bison or more, no additional tolerance will be given, and so-called tolerance would be given only as the population declines. The proposal is unacceptable to Buffalo Field Campaign, as we will not compromise the buffalo or make them pay blood sacrifice to gain ground. This proposal shows that broad public support for year-round buffalo habitat has been corrupted by ranchers to force an agreement, a public buy-in for slaughtering buffalo, and driving the population down to a few thousand. The proposal is still in draft form, and we are currently reviewing the details. In the meantime, please send a letter to Montana's Governor Steve Bullock, telling him you reject slaughter for habitat and urge him to step up and take a meaningful leadership role for America's last wild migratory buffalo. It is, after all, Montana's livestock industry anti-bison policies that currently drive all of the mismanagement of the world's most important bison populations. And here's a call out to participate in Buffalo Field Campaign's summer program. Buffalo Field Campaign is looking for at least 6 people to help us spread the word to save the herds this summer. Buffalo Field Campaign is looking for help from June until the first week of September. The positions would entail working in our Buffalo Museum in West Yellowstone, Montana, tabling and camping inside Yellowstone National Park, and going to music festivals and summer events. Each week we will have you do a different job so you will not be stuck doing one thing the whole summer. If spending your summer in the Yellowstone ecosystem and helping save the buffalo is something that interests you, please contact Buffalo Field Campaign. They promise this will be a summer you will never forget. And you can get all this information and more at the Buffalo Field Campaign's website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. That's buffalofieldcampaign.org. And if you want to send them something like money, they can always use that. Or something from their needs list, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. Once again, that webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And California has banned rat poisons in this story by Heather Somerville of Bay Area News Group. California regulators on Tuesday banned from stores some types of rat poison that are known to kill wildlife and pets and have for years been the target of lawsuits and advocacy efforts by environmental groups. The State Department of Pesticide Regulation has banned certain pesticide products known as rodenticides, chemicals to kill rodents that contain toxins that have also hurt California wildlife, killing at least 300 animals, including endangered species, in the last 2 decades. Rats and mice eat the pesticides, which are placed in and around buildings and homes, but it takes several days for the rodents to die, and they continue to eat the pesticide, which is stored in their body tissue. If pets and wildlife eat the poisoned rodents, they too end up being poisoned and can die. This is a practical, sensible regulation that goes a long way to protecting our wildlife, said Brian Leahy, director of the Department of Pesticide Regulation. Until now, any consumer has been able to buy the rodenticides. Decon is a common brand from retailers such as Home Depot and Walmart, and use them in and around their homes. But as of July 1st, the products will be removed from most stores, and only certified professionals such as a pest control business will be able to purchase them. The idea is to take it away from the general population who could misuse it and keep it in the hands of trained professionals, said Charlotte Fadip, Assistant Director of Communications for the Department of Pesticide Regulation. The new regulations were proposed last summer and were followed by a public comment period. The ban marks a victory for Californian environmental groups who have been calling for the state to end the use of rodenticides and have blamed regulators for failing to protect the endangered San Joaquin kit fox, golden eagle, Pacific fisher, and other wildlife from the poisons. And preservationists are fighting to save a rare albino redwood tree in California. This story reported by Layla Kearney, editing by Steve Gorman and Cynthia Osterman of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Northern California preservationists are fighting to keep a rare albino redwood, one of just 10 trees of its kind known to exist, from being chopped down to make way for a new commuter rail system, arborists and city officials said recently. The albino Camara Coast redwood, standing 52 feet high in a commercial district of Cotati, a town in California's wine country, is also the tallest and whitest specimen of its type, said Tom Stapleton, a certified arborist who is leading a group of researchers and community members pushing to save the tree. To lose this tree would be an absolutely huge loss to science and the ability to study albinism in redwoods, Stapleton said. The tree is a form of albino redwood with a genetic mutation that causes its branches to be striped in a candy cane-like pattern with a mix of green and white needles. But it stands 12 feet away from a planned stretch of the Sonoma-Marin area rail transit line, a voter-approved passenger rail and pedestrian bicycle pathway system. Sometime after construction begins on the 43-mile rail project in the area next month, the tree and its roots are slated to be removed to comply with Federal Railroad Administration safety regulations, said SMART spokeswoman Carolyn Glendening. If it were left in place, the systemic health of the tree would become compromised, and it could topple onto our tracks, Glendening said. Albino redwoods are a mutant variety of the evergreen species known as the California redwood, giant redwood, or coast redwood, which is named for the reddish color of its bark and includes the tallest living trees on Earth. There are only about 200 known albino specimens in the world, all of them in California, and they are typically distinguished by needles that are all white, Stapleton said. But the far more rare Camara albino redwoods have two sets of DNA that produce multicolored needles. The first albino redwood was discovered in Northern California in the 1870s, roughly 3 years after logging in the area began, said Sandy Leiden, an albino coast redwood expert and lecturer in Northern California. They're often called the phantoms of the forest, he said. Splotchy sunlight peeking through the typically dense redwood forest canopies make the trees with colorless, almost transparent needles hard to spot, which could explain why so few of them have been documented, Leiden said. Researchers say a lack of chlorophyll, the nutrient that turns needles on the trees green, causes the albino foliage, but little is known about what causes the lack of chlorophyll. Studying the mutant trees can teach scientists more about redwood ecosystems and inform ways to preserve the evergreen, Stapleton said. The Cotati redwood is the only Camara redwood mature and large enough to produce both male and female pine cones, when scientists can study to learn more about the plant, Stapleton said. He said he's working with the rail agency and Cotati city officials to try and relocate the tree on public land instead of hacking it down. And Sunoco oil pipeline leaks into an Ohio nature preserve. In reporting by Edward McAllister, additional reporting by Scott DeSavino and Salam Gebertekam in New York, editing by Chuzu Nomuyama and Garita Choi, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A major oil pipeline owned by Sunoco Logistics Partners, LP, leaked thousands of gallons of crude oil into a nature preserve in southwest Ohio late on Monday. Between 7 and 10,000 gallons of sweet crude leaked into the Oak Glen Nature Preserve, about a quarter of a mile from the Great Miami River, according to early estimates from the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency. The leak, which occurred on a line operated by Mid Valley Pipeline Company, a division of Sunoco, was discovered at 8:20 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Monday. The company shut down the line, which helped reduce the pressure of the leaking oil, an EPA spokeswoman said, but it was unclear if oil was still spewing from the pipe. Some oil reached a wetland a mile away, and on Tuesday, cleanup crews were preparing to vacuum the wetland, located 20 miles north of Cincinnati, Ohio. The oil did not appear to have reached the Great Miami River, though tests are still being completed, the EPA said. The extent of impact to the resource is currently unknown, said a statement from the Great Parks of Hamilton County, which oversees the Oak Glen Preserve. The EPA is assessing the situation to determine appropriate action. And Idaho is proposing to kill thousands of ravens to benefit imperiled bird species in the story reported by Linda Zuckerman, editing by Stephen Powell of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Idaho is planning to kill thousands of ravens to protect another bird whose eggs and chicks are among its prey, despite criticism that human development is a greater threat to the imperiled sage grouse than the black-winged bird. Ravens, carrion birds often properly depicted as omens of death or misfortune, will be killed by baiting them with poisoned chicken eggs, shooting them, and destroying a number of their eggs and nests, Idaho wildlife managers said. Ravens are protected by federal law, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently granted Idaho a permit to kill 4,000 ravens in four areas of the state over 2 years. That killing will begin this month and end in June, with a second round planned for next year, federal documents show. The pilot project, developed by the state legislature, aims to protect the greater sage grouse, a ground-dwelling bird dependent on sagebrush ecosystems in 11 western states. The sage grouse's fate is at the center of a battle pitting environmentalists against industries like ranching and oil, whose operations are tied to millions of acres of mostly federal lands. The Fish and Wildlife Service is to decide next year if the bird must be protected under the Endangered Species Act. Core sage grouse states like Idaho and Nevada have scrambled to craft plans to increase populations of the bird so it won't be added to the threatened and endangered species list. Nevada has already killed thousands of ravens in recent years. Listing could hamper activities like the development of new oil and gas fields, wind farms, utility lines, and roads. It might also result in restrictions on ranchers with permits to graze livestock on public lands where sage grouse dwell. Yet Idaho wildlife officials say habitat destruction and fragmentation linked to human activities are the greatest threats to sage grouse, with predation ranking 12 among 19 factors that contribute to the bird's decline. Between 1.6 and 16 million sage grouse populated the sagebrush plains of 13 U.S. states and three Canadian provinces in the 19th century, but their populations today are estimated between 100 and 500,000. Every spring, male sage grouse, which stand 2 feet high, return to historic strutting grounds known as leks to perform elaborate courtship dances during which they inflate yellow air sacs on their chests to impress female onlooking birds. And here's a tale of a Minnesota moose mystery, written by Brent McDonald of the New York Times. For moose, this year's winter-long deep freeze across the upper Midwest is truly ideal weather. The large, gangly creatures are adapted to deep snow. Their hollow fur insulates them like fiberglass does in a house, and the prolonged cold helps eradicate pests that prey on moose like ticks and meningeal worm or brainworm. Yet moose in Minnesota are dying at an alarming rate, and biologists are perplexed as to why. In the 1980s, moose numbered about 4,000 in the northwest part of Minnesota. Today, there are about 100. In northeast Minnesota, the population has dropped by half since 2006, to 4,300 from more than 8,800. In 2012, the decline was steep enough, 35%, that the state and local Chippewa tribes, which rely on moose meat for subsistence, called off the moose hunt. The mortality rate rebounded slightly this year, but moose continue to die at twice the normal rate to sustain a population. Researchers elsewhere along the southern edge of moose territory in New Hampshire and Montana are also beginning to notice declines in the animal's numbers. Seth Moore, a wildlife biologist in Grand Portage, theorizes that recent years of warmer, shorter winters and hotter, longer summers have resulted in a twofold problem. The changing climate has stressed out the moose, compromising their immune systems, and warmer temperatures have allowed populations of white-tailed deer, the carriers of brainworm, which is fatal to moose, to thrive. Still, I'm not necessarily convinced that brainworm is the silver bullet that's killing all of the moose, Dr. Moore said. There are a number of different issues. Michelle Karstensen, who is leading a $1.2 million moose mortality study by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources that is now in its second year, has been trying to pinpoint an underlying cause. Dr. Karstensen's team has captured and collared more than 200 moose, outfitting them with GPS devices that beam the animal's coordinates and temperature data every few hours. Yet the data coming back have been anything but conclusive, and Dr. Karstensen said that even if it can be confirmed that climate change is to blame, there may be little to be done. If we can really pinpoint the overlying cause, then can we even do anything about it, she said, or are we just documenting a species on its way out of Minnesota? And here's some news of biological diversity. With no killing over cattle, Oregon's wolf population triples in 3 years. Oregon's wolf population has tripled since the end of 2010, according to an annual wolf population estimate the state released recently. The new estimate of 64 wolves represents a threefold increase from the estimated 21 wolves at the end of 2010. In 2011, the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies filed a legal challenge against the state for killing wolves over conflicts with livestock. That suit ultimately resulted in new rules for the use of non-lethal methods to reduce conflict. While the suit was pending, the state could not kill wolves for wolf-livestock conflicts, so the use of non-lethal methods surged. As a result, even as the wolf population has tripled, conflicts have not increased and in some instances have decreased, and no wolves have been killed over livestock conflicts. Though wolf recovery in Oregon is still in its infancy, it's a real cause for celebration that the wolf population has tripled, said Amarok Weiss, West Coast wolf organizer at the center. Oregon's shift to more balanced strategies to manage wolf-livestock conflicts has created a landscape where the magnificent animals can begin to thrive. The state has a golden opportunity to build a national model for wolf recovery. And Grand Canyon trees are on the chopping block. The old yellow-bellied ponderosa pines of the Grand Canyon's majestic north rim may soon get cut down if we don't act fast. A timber sale in northern Arizona's Kaibab National Forest proposes to log more than 1,000 of these rare and beautiful trees, many of which are already tall two centuries ago. The sale would be bad news for many people who visit this world-renowned place every year and for the animals that depend on the trees to survive, including northern goshawks and other raptors. But it's not too late to stop these yellow bellies from being raised. The Forest Service hasn't yet auctioned them off to a logging company. Please go to www.biologicaldiversity.org and take action now to urge the Kaibab National Forest supervisors to stop the proposed wild buck timber sale and focus instead on thinning smaller trees that have been allowed to crowd the forest due to fire suppression. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday. I want to thank you for listening. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast or download a podcast of the Earth First Update, you can tune in tomorrow afternoon right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 3 o'clock for a rebroadcast of this show. If you live in Moscow, Idaho, please tune in to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, at 90.3 FM, their new high-power frequency, Monday nights at 9:30. Or you could go to the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. Search for the Earth First Update or Earth First Radio News. I'd like to point out that RadioForAll.net is currently having severe financial difficulties trying to keep their operation going. They have been a resource for those of us in the independent media movement by providing a place where we can upload and share our programs with many other independent and community radio stations. Please go to their website at RadioForAll.net. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll find a place to donate and keep Radio For All on the air. And thank you for listening to the Earth First Update.